The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
One of my favorite guests coming up, Victor Hansen. When I first read a bit of his column, The Doctrine of Media Untruth, I was reminded of a couple of verses of scripture out of the Bible. Isaiah said, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who turn darkness to light and light to darkness, who replace bitter with sweet and sweet with bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight." I don't know that Isaiah was writing about a modern-day media, but he could have been, in my view. And then the words of Paul came to mind out of Romans, he said, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Well, in this recent and fascinating column that I just cited, The Doctrine of Media Untruth, my guest says, as a general rule, when the New York Times, Washington Post, National Public Radio, Public Broadcasting Service, NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, and CNN begin to parrot a narrative, the truth often is found in simply believing just the opposite. Put another way, the media's truth, in quotes, is a good guide to what is abjectly false. Wow. Well, joining us to talk about it and explain his reasoning behind this, Dr. Victor Davis Hansen. He is the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, author of a number of great books, his latest, The Case for Trump. That's available, by the way, at Basic Books at basicbooks.com. Of course, your regular bookstores, Amazon as well. His own website for his private papers is victorhansen.com. Victor, always good to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me, Don.
Before we get to this very meaty, I told the folks the first hour, when I read some of your columns, I have to get online, go to a dictionary, because I love your way. You are truly a wonderful wordsmith. But more to the point of this first question, I need to, or at least want to get your assessment of the tragedy in Minneapolis, the murder of George Floyd, and the aftermath of mayhem and destruction that's now following. What were your own reactions initially, and what are they now?
Well, I think we were all shocked at the expression on the policeman's face as he put the knee for 8 minutes on George Floyd's neck. It was unnecessary, and it led to his death, obviously. And we were, I think, encouraged that the county attorney and city attorney moved very quickly to charge the officer in question. And then the president ordered a federal civil rights investigation. The state is involved. So the wheels of justice are turning very rapidly, and he'll face justice for that. And I also thought that something's wrong with Minnesota in general, and Minneapolis in particular. It's a blue state, blue state attorney general, blue mayor, liberal police chief. And yet just 4 years ago, an Australian white woman was shot by a black officer. And then 2 years later, a Latino officer shot a black suspect, both whom died. And so they have this high-profile interracial shooting. And something's wrong with a one-party state, as I can attest from California. As far as the tragic protests that turned to looting and arson very quickly, I thought that the Baltimore mayor 4 years, 4 or 5 years ago, Mayor Reynolds, had said that she'd given space for those who wanted to destroy was sort of an outlier. But when I heard the Michigan governor use that exact phrase, I wanted to give people space. And the mayor said that brick and mortar didn't really matter when they burned down the police precinct station. Then you get the idea that this is the first riot in my 66 years that I can remember local and state officials either being indifferent to the damage that occurred early on or almost trying to contextualize it or apologize for it. And then when I read that the mayor of New York's daughter was arrested trying to resist police, or that the state attorney general, Keith Ellison, had disseminated Antifa material, and his son, who's a city council member, was tweeting support for Antifa, and the daughter of the governor of Minnesota was reported to reassure people when the National Guard would come and protesters had to make the necessary adjustments. I've never seen any Orwellian situation quite like that. And that's, and now we have all of these cities that are falling apart, and they're all in liberal bastions, and yet the people in control don't seem to be on the side of the small business person that's the lifeblood of their cities. And they're contextualizing or apologizing or appeasing the protesters, looters, arsonists, whatever term we want to use. It's very strange. And I wrote that other article before all this about the media. But when you have the media go full Baghdad Bob style, where a building will be burning and the CNN commentator will say there's no evidence that this is a violent protest, or when another national news person has sort of sidestep looters as a cross between him and the camera, and he says that this is not violent, it's Orwellian. And so I know it's an election year, and I know that the left is doing to this disaster what they tried to do with Mueller and impeachment and COVID and the economic lockdown. I understand Joe Biden has some problems with the black community, and he's promised a diversity candidate, and he's trying to mine this tragedy, and the Democratic Party is. But it's something that I don't think any of us have quite seen the react. We've seen more violent, deadly riots, but we've never seen authorities so indifferent to the terrible toll it's taking on these cities.
And talk before this first break, and then we'll come back to your other article about Antifa, because the president this week's on record as declaring it a terrorist group, officially and formally so, I assume. What will that do, and is it not long overdue, perhaps, that they be identified for who they are? And are they not, many of them, funded from foreign sources, George Soros case in point?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a disconnect here that we get the idea that the oppressed were in need of economic parity, but yet when you looked at the looters, the inner city looters, they were taking Louis Vuitton bags and expensive sneakers. And then when you saw this elite group of Antifa, for the most part, I think you could say white elites, and they were out organizing arson and directing strategic attacks on particular stores, you got the impression they don't want a felony on their record. And if we crack down on them and we start to subpoena their records and find out that they were coordinating via email and the federal mails or whatever cross-state, interstate methodology they were using, they could face conspiracy charges. And as we know from the two sisters who firebombed the policeman, these are elites. These are people with very good jobs, and they sort of masquerade as weekend warriors and social activist protesters. But once they get hit with a felony, a career-ending felony, I think that'll have a lot of deterrence.
Victor, you juxtapose two excellent cases, I think, that of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo versus his counterpart in Florida, Ron DeSantis, as making your case on this point that really, if you want to believe the media's reports, just reverse what they're saying, basically, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at the media coverage of Governor Cuomo, you think he would be an adroit, skillful state executive. But when you actually look at the data, the state of New York has had more deaths per million than any nation, major nation in the world, and, of course, more than any state. And even out here in California that's mismanaged, it has half of our population. It's got about six times the number of deaths. So it's been an ungodly disaster characterized by the governor sending, you know, infected people into very vulnerable populations and long-term care homes, as well as, you know, sort of losing his temper and becoming frenetic, demanding ventilators and tent hospitals and hospital ships, and then not needing them and misallocating resources and being very unsteady. And yet somehow he's transmogrified into being a sober and judicious executive. We're here as Governor DeSantis has just very quietly decided that Florida is a very diverse state, as is New York, and he's going to have local solutions. Some places are going to be locked down, some aren't, and he's balancing the economy versus the threat to public health from the virus. And Florida's got about 1.5 million people more than New York, but its case rate, its death rate per those infected or per the 1 million population, just a fraction of what New York, and yet the media somehow tried to demonize him as some conservative Republican who's threatening the country's health. And this is all juxtaposed now in retrospect, Don, and this kind of paradox where the blue states and the media believe that if you go out and burn something without a mask or you destroy or protest without a mask, it's not a public health threat. But just 2 weeks ago, if you went out to start your business and create something to provide revenue for the federal treasury and you had a mask on, then you were somehow a public enemy. It's the strangest thing I've ever seen. This whole catastrophe is very depressing, you know, when you look at the health and the prognosis for America. Because we've got some very strange people in charge of large swaths of our public policy at state and local government.
And, of course, that compounded, as you've pointed out here, by a totally compromised media. There is really none of the mainstream media that you can consistently rely upon to tell the truth of the matter. But invariably, they write from and report from a political agenda. They have a visceral, really a visceral hate for this president, and they've been totally co-opted, it seems to me, by the liberal left. Is that saying it too extremely?
No, I think it's understating. I think they have fused with the Democratic progressive agenda, and it's not just you or I saying that. Remember, the New York Times Jim Rutenberg wrote a column by saying that the old rules of disinterested journalism no longer apply in the age of Trump. You have to be biased. So did Christiane Amanpour at CNN, that you just can't report neutrally on Trump. I think the same was true of the people at Univision. Jorge Ramos said, I just can't be unbiased. Trump is so bad, I have to be an advocate, a partisan. He said that. I think they haven't been shy about that. They feel that their noble ends justify any means necessary to destroy Trump, and they're not at all sorry. They show no remorse with these crazy walls are closing in bombshell supposed disclosure that any day Mueller was going to indict Donald Trump, and he was clearly guilty of Russian collusion. When the whole thing blew up, it was almost a pathetic coup attempt by the Obama administration leftovers during the transition that they were trying to remove a president. They have no contrition. They don't apologize. They just move on to impeachment, and they moved on to COVID, and they moved on to the lockdown, and now they've moved on to the protests. And they just can't allow Donald Trump to finish his constitutionally elected term, and they can't allow him to have a fair shot at putting his case before the people for reelection. And they feel that they're not going to allow that to happen.
And then you give us a litany of people that they have cut a lot of slack for, if not totally inverted the truth of the matter. The gubernatorial candidate in Georgia, Stacey Adams, Michael Avenatti, Bob Mueller, Adam Schiff, and then what they did contra to Devin Nunes, etc. Comment on that for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, well, very quickly, I read the Washington Post puff piece on Stacey Abrams. When I got done, I would have thought that she was part Elizabeth Taylor and part Madame Curie. And yet when I went back and I didn't know much about her, I found out till recently she owed $250,000 in credit card and IRS debt. She'd never been elected to a statewide office. And she was still complaining about a transparent election that she lost by 50,000 votes. And then when I looked at Adam Schiff, I realized that for a year he systematically lied and said, my team has had no contact with the whistleblower. They had all the time. They cooked it up with him. And they had testimonies from Brennan and Clapper and McCabe and Comey that they knew were, you know, accurate because they were under oath, and they were exactly opposite of what these characters were saying to the media. They were saying to the media, we know that Trump is guilty of collusion under oath to Schiff's committee. They were not. Schiff knew that, and yet he suppressed the information. And so, yeah, it's and then the Schiff memo was completely fraudulent, and they ran with that and damned David Nunes, and we found out that a Democratic inspector general confirmed all of the major arguments in the Nunes memo and rejected all of those in the Schiff memo. And then Robert Mueller, we thought he was a god. They thought he was, I don't know who, but cross between Lincoln and FDR or somebody. And he came into the with the Dream Team, the All-Stars. They were incompetent. They were partisan. They found nothing after 22 months. It was a complete waste of time. And then he testified before Congress. He didn't even know what the Steele dossier or Fusion GPS was, the source of the entire Russian hoax. And he seemed like he was almost in a Joe Biden state of enfeebleness, mentally addled. And yet we've been told that this guy was a pillar of the Washington establishment. And I could go on, but it's very depressing to see this media and this culture and this elite just deliberately fabricate and invent things because they feel that they have an anointed agenda, that we and we deplorables and irredeemables and scum or dregs, as Joe Biden called us, or clingers, just can't get it without their help. And so they feel they have a license to, you know, fabricate things.
In this last moment, nowhere, you say, has the doctrine of media untruth been more helpful than in following Trump during the coronavirus epidemic. I mean, they have been brutal on some of his statements, but take a moment to tell us about your thoughts there.
Well, you know, it's very strange because they just hated the travel ban, and now you can't find anybody who said, oh, I wish Trump had not issued that travel ban.
Yeah.
And then they said that he was a quack and he had no business talking about hydroxychloroquine, and now we're starting to get the first blind studies coming out that it has the efficacy, like he said. And then we were told that how dare he compare COVID to the flu and that it's going to be a million or a half million, and we don't know how many will eventually tragically die, but it does look more and more like a 1957 or 1968 flu season, not a catastrophic 2 to 3% of every 100 infected dying. So if he's erred in any fashion, he's tried to be fair to the deep state bureaucratic medical establishment and to the left, and gone halfway. And in retrospect, he probably shouldn't have gone halfway. He should have trusted his instincts and his own advisors. But he wanted to be magnanimous, and I think in some ways that allowed for this lockdown to continue far beyond what was necessary.
We need to talk again. Thank you, my friend, very much for what you write and the chance to talk with you about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. I'd like to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack. But if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.